Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is not an exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in the spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today. In the summer of 2019-2020, Australia burned. Temperatures soared and smoke blanketed much of the southeast of the country. But who was impacted? And who is the most vulnerable to future catastrophic events? Welcome to Policy Forum Pod, the podcast that digs a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and our region, and draws on the latest research to help us to better understand and address those challenges. I'm Sharon Bessel. I'm Professor of Public Policy at the Crawford School, home of Policy Forum Pod, where we offer a range of degree programs in executive education to help make sense of a complex world and to deliver better policy outcomes. Check out what we have on offer at crawford.anu.edu.au/study. And also check out the range of expert commentary and analysis at policyforum.net. Today, we are talking about wildfire and vulnerability. During the bushfires in Australia during 2019 and 2020, 34 people lost their lives, over 18 million hectares had been burned, and almost 3,000 homes destroyed. An interim report on the impact on wildlife released in July 2020 estimated that up to 3 billion animals died in the fires. In January 2020, a survey of 3,000 adults in Australia, undertaken by Nick Biddle and his colleagues here at the ANU, found that 78 or just over 78% of people were impacted, either directly or indirectly, by the bushfires, and subjective wellbeing had declined. It was catastrophic. As Joelle Gerges points out in a recent piece in The Conversation, Australia has always had climate variability, but that variability is no longer caused by natural factors alone. Moreover, variability is becoming more and more extreme. We are facing more frequent disasters, wildfires a year ago, currently devastating floods, and we're also seeing those floods in our northern neighbours at the moment in East Timor and eastern Indonesia. And so, what are the effects of disasters on health and well-being, and who is most impacted? To talk through the ways in which natural disasters, particularly wildfire, and vulnerability interact, we have two fabulous guests today. Quentin Grafton is Professor of Economics, Australian Laureate Fellow, convener of the Water Justice Hub, and Director of the Centre for Water Economics, Environment and Policy at the Crawford School of Public Policy here at the Australian National University. In April 2010, Quentin was appointed the chairholder of the UNESCO Chair in Water Economics and Transboundary Water Governance. He has a range of prizes to his credit. He is an outstanding researcher, and we are delighted to have Quentin joining us today. Hi, Quentin.
Oh, hi, Sharon. Real pleasure to be here. Thank you.
And joining Quentin and I is my brilliant pod partner, Dr. Anna Grenter-Hunter, who has swapped seats today and is going to let me ask her some questions about her research and her clinical work. Anna Grenter is a physician and a cardiologist with a strong focus on patient-centred care with preventative medicine focus. Anna Grenter's research interests are around health and public policy development, particularly the influence of public policy approaches to health outcomes. And as our listeners know, Anna Grenter is passionate about the social determinants of health. What our listeners may not know is that Anna Greta is also the chair of the ANU's College of Health and Medicine's Bushfire Impact Working Group, which has aimed to respond to the immediate needs of community, as well as to long and medium term prevention and preparation. Anna Greta, it is great to have you with us today on the other side of the mic.
Sharon, it's wonderful to be with you always, and it's very interesting to be on the other side of the table again.
So I wanted to start today perhaps with a more personal rather than a research-based question, and to ask you for your recollection of the fires that hit Australia in 2019-2020. I know I personally remember the smoke that blanketed our city in Canberra. I live in the south of Canberra. I could see Mount Tennant on fire and the fire moving towards us. And I remember driving to the bottom of our hill one day and seeing a range of fire trucks. There were, you know, 8 or 10 fire trucks, some from Queensland, army vehicles parked there ready to respond, and feeling something between absolute terror and incredible gratitude that we had people there defending our community. But Quentin, what are your recollections of that awful summer?
Oh, I wish I could forget them, but I think it was the duration of it all. So we are used to bushfires, and I hate to say it, we're also used to getting smoke, but never on the magnitude and the catastrophe that we had in 2019 and 20. And as you will recall, and I recall, you know, it gets underway around September of 2019. And personally, from my perspective, I was obviously living in Canberra. We had the smoke for months, but I went to the south coast of New South Wales for just after Christmas. And that's when the fires hit that particular location, which is around Merimbula, Bega, Eden. And I remember getting up in the morning and just saying, this is really bad. And so we went to the emergency shelter located in Merimbula. There was a lot of, I suppose, lack of information about what was going on. A lot of people there were on holiday. They didn't know what to do. They had tents. You know, you couldn't really breathe outside. The smoke was so bad. And so we readied ourselves to evacuate, but we didn't. And they did open up the road the following day. I think it was the following day, and we left at 5 a.m. I think they opened it around that time. So we managed to get out and just had enough fuel to drive back, because there was no fuel to be obtained in Merimbula or anywhere else. So there were several people that I know of who couldn't get out for a considerable period of time, several days. In fact, I think it was even longer than that. Yeah, so, you know, all those memories, smoke, fire. I remember in the evening the thunder and the sort of the lightning. And that's, I'd read about that, I'd heard about that, and then I could see it, you know, it was just a few kilometers away at most, and you could just see this trigger of going on with the fires. And I said, whoa, that's really kind of scary and amazing at the same time. Yeah, so those are my memories coming back, and the smoke. I'm asthmatic as well, so I had, you know, probably more of a challenge than other members in my family. But it was a challenge, and glad that it's over for the moment.
And that's the key, isn't it, for the moment. Anna Greta, what are your memories of that summer?
I think Quentin's just done a superb job of painting the picture that will be resonant with such a huge number of people who live in this southeastern corner of New South Wales and the ACT. It was an awful summer, and I remember my anxiety started for that summer, January beforehand, when we had that very unusual heat wave. And certainly in the communities that I'm part of, we had increasing concern about the summer ahead. And then it unfolded in a way that we had predicted and yet we hadn't prepared for. Those days, that day after Christmas, those couple of days of really intense fire and smoke, I'd taken my family down. They were down just past Eden. They were down on the other side of Twofold Bay. And so then I came back up to Canberra, and I was working on call at Canberra Hospital. So I was looking after people in hospital over that period of time. We were dealing with the fact that we had some smoke inside the building, dealing with the unfolding issues on the coast. And of course, like everybody, we're checking our phones on such a regular basis, looking at how the disaster was unfolding in other locations. I remember going out to a friend's place on New Year's Eve, and everybody there had somebody on the coast who, for whom it was a significant period. And so that dual catastrophe of the local environment here in Canberra, with the most horrendously bad air quality in the world, as well as such a huge proportion of our community who were under direct threat from bushfire on that coast. What an extraordinary time. And I really do. I remember the phrase that was uttered by one of our politicians towards the end of last year, that we always have bushfires. And I thought that was a way in which it gave us permission to relax into our summer holidays. And yet I think it was probably one of the most dangerous things that we could have done.
I think recalling the personal experiences of that summer are really useful before we start talking about what some of the research tells us and what some of the evidence tells us, because I think that that sense of fear and terror, but also of helplessness, is something that it's useful for us to keep at the forefront of our minds when we talk about these catastrophic disasters. And it can sometimes become abstract, but certainly at the time it wasn't. Quentin, when you started talking about your own experiences, you made the point that we see the fire season starting so much earlier, and we certainly saw that in the summer of 2019-2020. What are we seeing in terms of the evidence around trends of wildfire over the past, say, 40 years or so?
Yeah, so the trends are very clear. So we certainly are getting hotter temperatures and higher maximum temperatures as well as mean temperatures. And that particular period, the 2019 Black Summer fires, we'd also had drought. So we'd also had a dry period as well. So we had a very, very high fire hazard index, is another name for it, but that's essentially what we had, which is a combination of soil moisture measures as well as what's happening on the ground. So that measure was the highest it ever been, I think, for 60% of Australia. So it was that sort of extreme situation. And Anagata made the good point that this was coming in the sense it had been seen and had been talked about. So I forget the person's first name, but Mullins, I think, was one of the people who led a group of fire commissioners. I think it was at 26 or so, 20 odd. And they had made the call to meet with the Prime Minister, I believe it was in April of 2019. And they made the call that this was coming. And of course it did come, and people did pay some attention, but clearly the people who needed to make those decisions that needed to be made didn't make them as they needed to, despite the fact that this was a catastrophic situation. And getting back to your situation, the situation in context of trend, so not only do we have increasing temperature, we have that drying period for that three-year period. We also see it not only in Australia, but we see it globally. We see an increase in wildfires, not only in Australia, but in other locations in the world. And so the expectation is that this will get worse. It won't get better. Obviously, any trend that will have variability, and there's going to be variability. For example, we've had a fairly wet 12 months here in where we're currently living in Australia. So that has obviously made it a lot easier relative to let's say, the 2019-20. But the trend is very clear. We're going to have to live with this. We're going to have to manage this in a much more effective way. We had a Royal Commission that looked at and provided a bunch of recommendations about how we could do it better in Australia, all about information, monitoring, resilience issues. So there's a whole series of things that can and should be done, but we can't get away from the fact that it is going to get worse. We have a lot of flammable material in Australia. We have temperatures that are getting hotter, and there will be periods of time, as we've always had, but there will be periods of time where it will also be considerably drier. You put the all together, and we're going to have some seriously bad bushfires or wildfires, as they say, outside of Australia.
Which is terrifying when we think about what our experiences were a year or so ago. Anagata, your work is looking in particular at the health packs of smoke and heat. And what are the trends that we're seeing in terms of temperature increases? And what does that mean across Australia and for different places in Australia?
So, yes, I think heat is one of the big issues that we're going to face in terms of the health impacts of climate change. And in Australia, it's a particular issue that we need to pay perhaps a little bit more attention to. One of the issues that's less discussed in the heat sphere is the regional variability. And so if we look at some of the modelling that's been done about temperature change under various scenarios of our changing climate across Australia, there will be parts of Australia where heat stress becomes dominant. So there are parts of Australia where the summer can be very hot and humid, and it's a combination often of heat and humidity which makes the habitability particularly troublesome. And there's modelling that's been done that shows that the increase in heat stress days, particularly across the north part of Australia, will be significant. We are expecting to see some trend in terms of mortality that goes with that. The data that we have so far has suggested around 2% of Australian mortality may be attributable to hot weather and to hot temperatures and to heat wave type events. But we do need to get more nuance, I think, into our health data so that we can make a better prediction into the future. What we all know from our experience is that living in those hot, intense environments for protracted periods of time can have detrimental effects to our health, our mental health, our physical health and well-being. And I think these are some questions that we really need to be looking into.
Quentin, you've recently written with your colleague Sonia Atker at the National University of Singapore about the interactions between socioeconomic disadvantage and the experiences of the bushfires in Australia in 2019-2020.
Yes, I have, and that's a paper that's going to be published very shortly in Climatic Change. And so Sonia took the lead on that work. And what we did was an analysis looking at fire hazard or wildfire hazard, which looks at the extent and also distance to settlement over large parts of Australia over that period of time, 2019-20.
And can I ask you, Quentin, just as a little treat for the methodologists who are listening in, without going into so much detail that the non-methodologists are lost, how did you go about that research? Was that using existing data sets or
exactly.
what did you do?
It was existing data sets. So we've had reasonable data sets in Australia, but we put some of the data together to be able to come up with our own particular measure of hazard measure. And, of course, in terms of socioeconomic disadvantage, those measures already exist. Australia Bureau of Statistics have those sorts of numbers. And so we use those numbers at a statistical area one and was able to look at the impact of that with a whole range of controls, because there's a whole range of things that determine the impact associated with bushfires or wildfires. And we were able to make a determination that those communities, those people who were in those areas that have the worst socioeconomic disadvantage, or the worst off, actually were the most vulnerable to wildfire hazards in 2019-20. And so that may not come as a surprise to some people, depending on how well they know Australia or how well they know this literature, but it's certainly an important message. And that important message is that the impacts of wildfires or the impacts of floods or the impact of a variety of these natural disasters that are climate related or weather related are, of course, not just uniform. In other words, that people who are in the worst context, in the context of their income, in terms of their ability to respond, in terms of the bounce back, those are the people who are the most vulnerable, and they're the ones who get the hit the worst. So in a flooding situation, people don't have enough money to afford insurance. And they say, well, why don't they do that? Well, because the cheaper houses are on the floodplain. So that's the only place they can get a house. So on the floodplain, depending where you are, I was in Townsville just a week and a half ago. There were floods there in 2017, for example. You'd be paying $8,000 to $9,000 a year. And a low income, you can't afford to pay that. And in other places, you'd be paying $35,000 a year insurance for a house. So those are the sorts of situations and the places that exist now in Australia that are uninsurable. It doesn't matter what you pay, you can't basically insure your property because it's viewed as such a high risk situation. So you can see the people who have the least income will be the ones who will be in those situations in terms of not being able to afford insurance. But that also comes with a whole set of other issues. So it's not just themselves, the individual, and the household. It's also about the community. And these communities of disadvantage exist in terms of their close proximity to each other. So they're not randomly located in different places. They are clearly in particular locations. And those are the places that also suffer from the least ability to manage in those situations, both in terms of before the fires come, but also to manage after the fires have actually happened. And so the implication of our work is, I think, fairly straightforward. If we've got a bucket of money to deal with wildfire in terms of prevention, in terms of fuel reduction, in terms of putting in fire barriers, et cetera, in terms of training, in terms of – we need to make sure that those funds are allocated in a disproportionate way to support vulnerable and certainly communities that are in low socioeconomic advantage or greatest disadvantage. That's a clear implication in terms of our work. So that's not how it happens. So typically we will direct our resources to those places which have the high population densities, typically higher income, and that's where resources get allocated. So we need to make sure there's a redistribution to ensure that those people who are most vulnerable actually do get extra support for where they are and the ability to respond and both before and after an event.
Quentin, you pointed out that your research identifies those communities that are particularly at risk because of disadvantage. Were you able to see whether there are particular groups within those communities that are the most marginalised, or is it really the community that starts to determine the extent of vulnerability?
We just looked at community, but clearly even within a community, there will be people who will be more disadvantaged than others. So, for example, you take a poor community, there'll be some people who don't even have a car. Okay, so let's just work that out. When there's a wildfire coming towards you, you don't have a vehicle to get into and drive away. So you're absolutely dependent on friends, family, whatever, to take you out of there, because there's no way that you can run from a wildfire. So that's just one example where you become more vulnerable even in a poor community. And then, of course, there's a range of activities that you could do before the event happens. Remember, of course, Black Summer was a very special period of time in terms of the dryness, in terms of the temperature, catastrophic wildfires. So a lot of things that people would have tried to do and did do just wouldn't have worked. But nevertheless, in a standard, if you want to call that type of fire year, there are a number of activities that can at least reduce your risk. But those activities are dependent on having equipment, depending on having training, dependent on even, as I just said, had a vehicle, dependent on and actually having the opportunity to do that. If you're a casual worker, it may be difficult to be able to do a whole range of different things that to support yourself or reduce your risks. So yes, clearly it's going to vary within a community. We did not do that analysis. It's within a particular community. So whatever the individuals are, we haven't done that analysis.
Next step, maybe, the research. But Anna Greta, I wanted to turn to you now and ask about both your research and your clinical work. What do you see in terms of these interactions between smoke and heat and socioeconomic disadvantage?
Well, I think that Quentin's just painted the picture, really, that these risks are interchangeable. And so if we think about our model of health or illness, about the biological disease, which we often get our health data, we define things like as heart disease or lung disease or cancers. There are a series of things in our environment around us that will influence the rates of disease. And the social determinants of health are well understood. And the life expectancy gaps that are demonstrated around the world between very high socioeconomic groups and lower socioeconomic groups can be quite extraordinary, up to some decades, particularly of disability-free life expectancy. So we know that these socioeconomic factors, education, the way in which our communities operate can make a big difference to life expectancy. So on top of that, we've got this threat magnifier or threat alterer of the environment, so the environment in which we live. And there are tremendous advantages to living in beautiful natural environments. We know that that's good for our health and well-being, but we're also potentially a more vulnerable population when we're exposed to things like heat in the urban heat island effect in our outer suburbs of Sydney and in Melbourne, the socioeconomically precarious populations living in accommodation where much more likely to have difficulty with access to air purification and to air conditioning during very significant periods of heat. And so the interrelationship between the environmental determinants of health and worse health outcome for an already disadvantaged population, I think, is already understood in some of the literature.
Quentin, we will take a break in a moment, but before we do, I just wanted to ask you a little about the research that you also do on water and water justice, and to ask whether we see similar interactions between socioeconomic status and access to increasingly scarce water supplies in Australia, but also internationally.
Yeah, good question, Sharon. Yes, absolutely we see that. So it's the poor and vulnerable who have the least or worst access to water. So that when I say access to water, it's access to water in terms of drinking water. It's for bathing purposes. It's for washing. It's cleaning, of course. And it's also in terms of sanitation. So those people on the lowest income level, those people with the least secure housing, are the people who typically have the worst access. And when I say worst access, that access in an Australian context means that most of us in Australia live in large metropolitan centres. Now, the water is perfectly safe to drink, and we will drink it 24/7, and we expect that to be that quality. But if we go to remote communities in Australia, there's water there that most Australians, more than 90% of Australians would not drink. They would not drink it. If they were living in Sydney and Melbourne and they got that water coming out of the tap, there'd be a change in government. That's the nature of the water quality that we're talking about. So there's a variety of examples to point to: uranium contamination in bores, fluoride contamination. There's also PFAS contamination that's a pollutant. There's a variety of reasons why that happens. There's organic pollutants. And so it's smaller communities in remote areas. Those particular communities are the ones that suffer the most from poor access or very low quality access in terms of water. And again, it's a similar sort of story. It requires resources to provide that. It's not difficult to provide high quality water. We have access to groundwater. We can do a variety of treatments, reverse osmosis, for example. There's a number of things that can be done as long as there's proper monitoring, proper control, but it requires resources. And if you add up all these people who are in these remote communities, I don't know what the number is, and we're working on it right now in the Water Justice Hub, but it's in the tens of thousands. So the population of Australia is more than 26 million. So tens of thousands is a lot of people from my perspective. They're distributed over different parts of primarily northern Australia, and they don't count when it comes to adequate resourcing for their needs in terms of water. And we signed up, among other countries, for Sustainable Development Goals for 2030, which includes water for all. And we're still not going to deliver that in Australia unless we do something about it now, actually act, make sure that we can start putting the resources in. And it's straightforward to do. It's technically very straightforward to do this, but we haven't done it yet. Instead, we're putting billions of dollars, that's thousands of millions of dollars, into water infrastructure for building dams or for irrigation purposes, yet we're not allocating those funds for those sorts of purposes. So yeah, and it's a bigger picture story than just Australia. There's all sorts of places in the world where the poor don't have access. So for example, they're in settlement type situations, so they don't have a tenure in terms of the land or in terms of the structure that they're in. And so they don't even have pipe water, whatever that is. So they have to get it carted in, or they bring it in themselves. That's in an urban context. And of course, if you go into a rural context in a whole variety of countries in the world, then there's no such thing as a centralized system. You have to go out there and get the water either from a lake, from a groundwater, or from a stream, or something like that. Typically, women are the ones who collect that water. And in some parts of the world, they spend hours a day collecting that water. It's a very tedious, difficult, challenging task just to get enough water to drink and do some basic bathing. So those are the sorts of things that are happening globally. Those are the sorts of things that are happening in Australia. And it is absolutely connected to socioeconomic disadvantage.
I think I can feel a podcast coming on in the future that is focusing specifically on water justice. And I know in the work that we did around multidimensional poverty in Indonesia, in the remote islands off the coast of South Sulawesi, almost 60% of people didn't have access to hand washing facilities in their own home. So in the context of COVID, you know, this is really catastrophic. But I think for now, we will take a short break and we will come back to talk a little more about bushfires and vulnerability. So stay with us, listeners.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
Welcome back. We're here talking with Quentin Grafton and Anna-Greta Hunter about the impacts, and particularly the impacts on the most vulnerable, of the bushfires that we saw in Australia in 2019-2020. And I wanted to turn now to looking forward and thinking about some of the things that we need to do. Quentin, you started talking before the break about prevention. And obviously one critically important strategy is prevention of fires in the first place. You mentioned the different approaches taken depending on the socioeconomic status of a community. Can you just talk a little more about that and the differences that we see across communities, including one of the issues that you raised in your recent article with Sonia Atka that I thought was both interesting and disturbing, which was around the role of professional and volunteer firefighters across different communities. So what are we seeing in terms of prevention?
Well, so prevention is there's sort of three aspects to it. One is the reducing the fuel load. Another one is putting in sort of fire barriers. So that's the prevention activity. And then the other one is a sort of a data system, centralized survey system, and making sure that if their fire does get started, that you can react quickly. So those are sort of three things that you do, two before and one, I suppose, during the fire season. So let's say the state of New South Wales, I think there's around 7,000 or so professional firefighters, and they do a wonderful job. So let me just give a plug for firefighters, both professional and volunteer, who put their lives on the line. And firefighters did die during the 2019-20 Black Summer. So they put their lives on the line, and some of them lost their lives. So these firefighters are primarily in the towns and cities. And so they're professionals, so they're trained to do that job, and they do it very well. But as you move out further out into the regional parts of Australia or New South Wales, then you get to smaller communities, then you start to rely more heavily on volunteer firefighters, and you can have them working, professionals and volunteers working alongside each other. Of course, there's around 70,000, I believe, in New South Wales, who are these volunteer firefighters. And they do get training, but the training will depend on their ability to attend, which of course is dependent on their mobility, which is dependent on their job, or those sorts of factors. And equipment also is also an issue as well, you know, how that equipment gets distributed. So those factors come into play, and it's not that there's anything necessarily sinister about it. It's just that the factors come into play as you move out from a core central location, a city, towns, and then smaller towns, and then I go further and further out. The ability to be able to manage that in an effective way diminishes. Certainly when the fire occurs. And so those people who are in those locations, which have the lower property values, the land values are typically much lower, they're the ones become more vulnerable. So they're more exposed in the context of wildfires, but they're also more vulnerable for the reasons that we've already outlined. And so to overcome their socioeconomic disadvantage, we need to ensure that they get proportionately more per capita in the context of making sure that their resources are sufficiently adequate to try to compensate for the challenges that they face. And that's the bottom line, essentially the conclusion of our work. That's outside of my professional expertise to say how that should be done. I'm not in that business or line of business, but that's certainly what our results are telling us, and it's probably not a surprise to people as well who know this sector very well. But certainly, that's what the data tells us, and that tells us that we need to do it differently, and we can do it differently. And it's a question of not only increasing the pie as required, but it's also a question of making sure that's allocated in a way that those communities that are most vulnerable are adequately looked after, especially before an event happens. Because when a big catastrophe happens in 2019-20, when there's fires all over the place, there is a very limited number of fire fighters available, and so you just bring it to a core to protect larger locations. So you have to do it before these events arise. Yep. To make sure that those risks are mitigated. They can't obviously go to zero, but mitigated in those locations where people are in particularly low socioeconomic advantage or greatest disadvantage.
And look, that's one of the most, I guess it's an often quoted part of that whole Black Summer experience, that unprecedented is not an excuse for being unprepared. And if listeners are thinking about how we might prepare for the future, I really commend that Royal Commission into National Natural Disaster Arrangements. It's quite an extraordinary document that goes through in detail both the sorts of things that we might be contending with, as well as offering a framework analysis on what we might do. And I think one of the most important starting points is recognising, as we've already discussed, that summer experience may simply have been a taster for what we may be contending with over the next 50 years. If we start to actually build some of the climate science into our policy framework, preparing for environmental challenges that will evolve over Australia in the coming decades is going to be a test of our imagination. And one of my favourite phrases from that Royal Commission document is the phrase strategic imagination. The Black Summer experience, I know there are many people who were calling for better preparation. There are a whole series of very good ideas about how we could have been better prepared. And yet that Black Summer experience tested our imagination. I had spent time worrying about it. I didn't imagine the smoke. We hadn't prepared adequately for a bushfire smoke emergency. We'd prepared for drought and for water and for heat and for fire, but we hadn't prepared anywhere near as much for smoke. And so that's an imagination failure, and we need to do better in terms of imagining the sorts of challenges ahead. I think health prism is quite an interesting way to think about better preparation, because we want to provide a framework that allows for the individual to health to be best protected. That often involves engaging communities and working together locally on the ground. And that means in vulnerable communities, in less vulnerable communities, but it's particularly important for those small towns and smaller centres around Australia who are often much more vulnerable to extreme weather events, so flooding and fire, and in fact, protracted drought can offer a similar sort of model. There is a tremendous amount of research that's going on at the moment looking at community adaptation strategies, and I think that's really where we need to be spending some more time. With our imagination hat on, trying to imagine a future which we're not going to want to contend with, and there was that quite remarkable piece in The Conversation just recently, imagining Australia at a 3-degree world in the future. This will challenge us emotionally, it challenges psychologically, but unless we go into some of those really difficult territories, we're going to find ourselves yet again woefully underprepared.
Anna Greta, can you give us an example perhaps of just one of those community adaptation strategies that we need to be thinking imaginatively about? Do we have some examples?
Look, there's some really interesting research that's been done out of RMIT. I've just been speaking recently over the last couple of months with one of the researchers down there on resilience adaptation plans for small regional centres. And it's an opportunity for groups for in a regional centre. We're often living in towns like that because of all sorts of different reasons, including the fact that they can be great places to live. But they're often really climate vulnerable environments with forestry nearby or drought vulnerable, heat vulnerable environments. So the sorts of things that are available there are for communities to sit down and to work their way through what are our local assets? What are the things that make living here great? What is it about the people? What is it about the place? What are our natural assets? What are our vulnerabilities? What are our climate vulnerabilities? How vulnerable are we to a heatwave event? What's the resources that we have around that? How can we defend ourselves against bushfire in a more convincing way? And I've been having some of these conversations. I have a place down in northern Victoria. We talk about bushfire risk in a really difficult environment, where if we're up against the climactic conditions we had over New South Wales in 2019, we're facing catastrophic risk in Victoria at some point if those variables fall. And so we're raising the idea of what is indefensible. So if you've got areas that might be very high bushfire vulnerability, is this area defensible? Can we save our forest? Can we save our infrastructure? What are we prepared to commit as a society to do that? And I think that's a key question. Sharon, I'm afraid I think it comes back to some of our other conversations about what we value in our community. And I think if we value our people, the people who we share space with and our place, then we would invest some more time and effort into making what might be less easily defended, more easily defended against these extreme weather events.
We've talked a lot about the Australian context today, but of course globally there are major issues. And Quentin, we already started to talk about those in relation to water. But we see these major issues playing out around poverty, disadvantage and vulnerability to natural disasters. Are there lessons from Australia's experience that we can apply globally that are useful for other countries in thinking about how to both respond and prevent these situations?
I think there are lessons. I think there's lessons from successes and there's lessons from failures. So there's one lesson that comes to mind from 2019 is that when you have experts and professionals knocking on the door of the Prime Minister or whatever it might be, those people should be listened to. And it's not, you wouldn't expect a prime minister or president to have all the answers. I wouldn't expect that person. But if you get a bunch of experts knocking on your door, I think you should listen to them and follow through in terms of working out how you can prioritize the limited resources, which some countries have very limited resources, not like Australia.
And maybe some of those experts have some of the answers.
Maybe they do. Maybe they do. But Anna Greta's point was very well taken. So experts will be expert typically in one or two narrow areas. That's typically what defines an expert in some sense. They can't be an expert of everything. So I think it's the issue of communities and engaging with those communities in terms of their priorities and their needs. And that requires, you know, various processes that allows it to feed up into the decision-making echelons. And that's another conversation about deliberative democracy. But the issue about social and economic injustice is that those people do not have voice, or if they have voice, I mean, it's not that they don't have voice. It's just that no one is listening. No one's listening to what they have to say. So that has to change, and it has to change in Australia and has to change in other places in the world as well. So until and unless we have a true, robust, representative democracy where we can have those sorts of conversations and listening to the people, then we are going to continue to make those mistakes, whether it's in COVID, whether it's in wildfire, whether it's in water, flooding, whatever it might be, we are going to continue to make those mistakes. So there's a discussion right now about increasing the dam wall, the major dam at Sydney, you know. So having that discussion and debate about with community as well as with experts is critical to making sure we make the right decisions. And if we don't make those decisions and we don't make them in a timely way, we're going to suffer huge consequences. So as was alluded to and mentioned a few times, the issue of climate change is right on the agenda right now, not only in terms of bushfires. sea level rise. There is a huge context and consequence associated with sea level rise, particularly in Australia, but in many other countries. And so we got to prepare for that. We got to do something about it, and we need to do it now. And it's not about, well, wish we would just go away. Well, it's not just going to go away. We have to prepare and plan. And we need to make sure it doesn't get that the expenditures don't just go to people who have very expensive houses right on the beach, that the resources are allocated in a way that would look after the most vulnerable. That's the sort of lessons that I think we can share.
I think this conversation is one that we will return to several times again over the course of this year. There are so many issues that have been raised that we can go into a little deeper. And I think that theme, Anna-Greta, as you noted, that keeps coming up again and again and again of listening is just so fundamentally important. I just wanted to wrap up by asking each of you, in brief, if you had just one piece of advice for the government, the Australian government I'm talking about here, in terms of first steps, what we need to do now, what would that piece of advice be? Anna-Greta, perhaps you can lead off.
Look, I am a big fan of that Royal Commission document, and I would ask the government to sit down and form a multi-party group that actually begins the conversation, that starts with scenario outcome planning around what happens as the temperature rises, looking at the sorts of climate vulnerabilities we have around this country, thinking about the health of our population and the health of the continent on which we live. That would be an extraordinary first step. And from that, I do think that by starting with acknowledging the science and the sorts of threats that we might be up against, that we'll be in a much better place to move forward.
Quentin.
I concur, follow through the Royal Commission when it comes to the bushfires, but I'd say foresighting. So that's just the process of looking into the future, visioning that future and making sure that we don't end up in the place we don't want to be, that we actually do something now to have a different future. And if we don't do that, then we're going to be in seriously bad ways. So that's what I'd recommend we do.
Quentin and Anna-Greta, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been such an incredibly informative conversation. And as I said, one that I think we will come back to multiple times this year. Thank you too to our listeners for joining us. And don't forget to reach out to us. You can contact us on Twitter at APPS Policy Forum, that's APPS Policy Forum, or you can contact us by email at podcast@policyforum.net. Probably the best way to get in touch with us is to join our Facebook group. You can just type Policy Forum Pod into the search bar and you will find us there. Don't forget to leave us a review. We love to hear your feedback. We love to hear your suggestions for the kinds of issues we should be talking about on the pod. And you can subscribe to us wherever you get your favourite podcasts from, Acast, Apple Podcasts or Spotify, we're on all of those platforms. As always, a huge thanks to our producer, Angus Blackman, and we will be back again with another episode next week. But for now, from me, Sharon Bessel, it's bye-bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.